Welcome back to Ryan and Brian's Bible Bistro. I'm Ryan.
And I'm Brian.
And this is the Bible Bistro, a podcast all about the Bible,
theology,
and all things related to the Christian faith. That's right. I'll just finish it. So we'll just move on from that. How are you doing today, Brian?
Doing well. I never know what you expect of me. You just like start and I don't know what's happening.
I never know what you expect of me either. You're like, hey, Ryan, remember that one verse with that guy whose name was hard to pronounce? You know, and I'm like, no. And you're like,
Moses?
You're yeah, like, exactly.
We know Melchizedek.
That's a deep cut. You know, oh gosh. And then, or like, and you put these two porticos together and what, how many sides is that? Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about.
It's five sides.
I understand. Now that I have like a visual picture, I don't know what you're saying. You're just like, I'm saying words. You should know. Anyway, we're back. I'm caffeinated. I've had a little bit of coffee.
I had coffee earlier, but I haven't had any this afternoon. So.
Yeah, well. Cheers. Yeah, cheers. So we're back. We're continuing today.
Yeah.
Season four is well underway. And if all goes well, previously, I'm just going to mention this. Previously, we would have had a guest on the podcast, Andrew Root. So if it has not happened before this, I'm sure it's going to be great. Again, podcast recording time has not happened before this, but excited for that. And we've got some other guests we're working on right now that you're working on, Brian.
Yes.
Wink, wink, nudge, nudge. Get on it.
Some special guest.
Another couple other special guests. But anyway.
Maybe some location stuff. Who knows?
Location. Ooh, let's talk locations about that. Confirmed.
Locations confirmed, but we should do some shorts or something there. So.
Yes, absolutely. Well, we are back. We're continuing Leviticus, the series that you've all been begging for. Leviticus.
What other podcast is doing a series in the book of Leviticus?
You know what? I don't think there is. Everybody's like, oh, this is going on in the world. This is wrong. Deconstruction. We're like, Leviticus.
Doesn't make us better.
Well, maybe.
A little. Okay. So anyway. We just finished up chapters 1 through 7. We kind of did those as a unit, spent a couple of weeks talking about the sacrificial system. So the next thing that happens in the book of Leviticus is there's a focus then upon the leaders. So here's how the sacrificial system is supposed to take place. And it was fascinating because I was thinking, as I was reading through Leviticus this time and kind of doing some studies and so forth, it had never occurred to me. Did I ever tell you I had a class in graduate school that was called Pentateuchal Studies?
Pentateuchal?
That's what it was called. It was a great class. It was a fantastic class. We just focused on the Pentateuch. So we did talk about Leviticus quite a bit, but it had never occurred to me that, I mean, what's it like to start up a sacrificial system, right? And that's kind of what we get a little glimpse into that today in chapters 8 through 10, because you've got these leaders, the priest, right? And so how do you offer sacrifice? And there's some interesting things I think we'll learn here. How does this begin? You know, do you just say, okay, we're going to start up on March 1st and, you know, there it is? Right. Or, you know, how do you
ramp up to this?
And so... The key word today, I think, is going to be consecrated, that God is saying to the priests, you are a set-apart people, you are a consecrated people in order to offer these sacrifices on behalf of the whole people. But they have to be set apart first. Their sins have to be forgiven first in order for them to be leading the people in this way. And so it's an interesting thought. It's an interesting concept, this idea of how do you start the beginning of the sacrificial system that's supposed to go on and supposed to be the way, again, like we talked about a little bit last week, the way that God is giving for his people to draw near to him. So that's what we'll look at today. Okay. An interesting little story, too. I mentioned in the introduction to Leviticus that there are a couple of narratives, and this is one of those two narratives that we find in the book of Leviticus.
Okay. Well, let me ask you a question before we kind of get into this. So you say the word consecrated, kind of set apart. How should we think differently about this, like the idea of holiness, which I think, you know, sometimes has been like set apartness and then consecrated. So do you see these as kind of synonyms with each other? How should we think about this?
I think they're similar. So I would say consecrate is the idea of, I don't want to say this, to put oneself in, I'm making this definition up off the top of my head.
I love it.
The way I would define consecrate is the act of setting oneself apart for holiness. Let's say something to that effect. You get okay. what I'm saying?
In other words, pre-holiness.
I think it's I would say it's what I started to say was it's the way you become holy, but it's not really exactly correct. It's setting yourself apart from it. It's about separating yourselves from the things that would cause you not to be holy and allowing then God to work in a way that is able to make you holy.
Okay.
So that's kind of, you know, now I'll go back and read a definition. I'll think, oh, I forgot this part of it. But you know, to consecrate, of course, is a verb. The other word, and here's the word that keeps coming to my mind. This is more of a New Testament word though, is the word sanctify. Mm. You know, and this is Jesus uses that for his disciples, talking about, you know, asking God to sanctify them, to set them apart. And that has within its root the word holy. I was just talking to somebody about this last week in English. You know, English is such a messed up language, and it's so much easier typically if I'm an English speaker who wants to learn Spanish, for example, that's going to be a more regular language. But if you're a Spanish speaker trying to learn English, there are all kinds of irregularities. And one of our difficulties is, I didn't know this was going to be a lecture on linguistics, but one of the difficulties we have with English is that we've borrowed from so many different languages, mm-hmm. and we do it inconsistently. So it's like, hey, we're going to borrow this part of the verb from this language. We're going to borrow this part of the verb from the other. So you get, you know, I go, you go, you know, but then it's I went. It's like, shouldn't it be goad? No, it's not goad. It's went. You know? Yeah. So we got those kind of things. But here's an example of that. In the New Testament, the Greek word for holy and sanctify have the same root. And we've borrowed from two different languages. We borrowed, I think one's Latin and the other's Anglo-Saxon, I believe, is the reason there's that difference. So we use the word sanctuary or saint or sanctify, mm-hmm. but then we also use this word holy. But in Greek, they would have had the same root to them.
Okay.
So that's not what we're talking about today. But anyway, consecrate, I would say, is more the action. It's more the verb
moving,
part of this.
Moving you towards
putting yourself in a position where you okay. can be holy. Is
okay,
kind of
well,
way
I just wanted to, as you were saying, good. Consecrate and that set apart,
yeah.
just as I'm thinking, is kind of going, well, this sounds like the word holy a little right. bit, and that right. you know, God is so holy, he's so different, set apart different. From us.
Yeah, and there's two ways in which God is holy, but that's yeah. another
that's another I didn't want to go down there. I gotcha. All right. So
okay.
I'll let you get on with what you want to talk about.
That's fine. Let's look at Leviticus chapter 8. So I'm going to look at a little bit of a longer section. I thought we might break this up some as we read it,
okay.
Just because it's going to be so long for a listener to listen to. So go ahead and read verses 1 through 4 for me, and then I'll pick up after that for a while.
Yeah. The Lord said to Moses, bring Aaron and his sons, their garments, the anointing oil, the bull for the sin offering, the two rams, and the basket containing bread made without yeast, and gather the entire assembly at the entrance to the tent of meeting. Moses did as the Lord commanded him, and the assembly gathered at the entrance to the tent of meeting.
So Aaron and his sons, Aaron was the first high priest. His sons were the first priests to serve in this role. They were all, of course, you might remember this from the book of Leviticus, because Moses is Aaron's brother. But both of Moses and Aaron, and Miriam is their sister, but all three of them, their parents were both Levites, both the husband and the wife. The father and the mother of Aaron are Levites. So Aaron becomes the high priest. The Levites become the tribe of the high priest, and then we have also the priests coming from his sons. So they're from the same tribe as well. So here we have gathering all this material, and here again you kind of get what I'm saying. This beginning of the system, like how do we get it started? Mm-hmm. Well, let me see. You're going to need a basket of unleavened bread. You're going to need the priest. Yeah. You're going to need, you know, a ram. You know, so
it's like starting up an old engine. You know, like you'd have like a shotgun shell and crank it a couple times and then you get going.
It's a little bit like that. So let me go ahead and read a few verses here. Moses said to the assembly, "This is what the Lord has commanded to be done." Then Moses brought Aaron and his sons forward, and he washed them with water. He put the tunic on Aaron, tied his sash around him, clothed him with a robe, and put the ephod on him. And by the way, if you look back the in Exodus, there, this ephod was designed. God had very specific instructions about what it was to look like and how it was to be used and so forth. He also fastened the ephod with a decorative waistband, which he tied around him. He placed the breastpiece on him and put the Urim and Thummim in the breastpiece. Then he placed the turban on Aaron's head and set the gold plate, the sacred emblem, on the front of it as the Lord had commanded Moses. So what is that, when you listen to that, what does that make you think of? Or how do you see that?
That's a spectacle.
And so he's kind of getting equipped.
He's putting on a uniform, right. Like ready for something here.
The movie image I'm thinking of is Iron Man, you know, when Iron Man stuff, yeah, that's,
kind of, you know, here's Tony the turban, Stark, golden fleet.
Right. Ding, ding. So it's a little bit like that. He's getting all garbed out. And one of the interesting things to me, and this is part of my Pentateuchal studies class, one of the interesting things to me is that Aaron and the priest are almost treated in the same way that the furniture of the tabernacle are. So you get what I'm saying? They have that kind of role where they are to be used. They have this purpose, right? They have this use, and that is to bring people into the presence of God. They are a part of this overall process that people are going to come and bring sacrifice and offer it. And so they're an instrumental, they're an integral part of the sacrificial system. And so, you know, all of these, Thummim, that's easy for me to
Uma
say.
Uma and the Thurman, Uma yeah. Thurman.
Wow. That all these things are, you know, they have a purpose, they have a use, and so he's being equipped in all this so that he can serve in the way that he's supposed to.
Okay, so, I have a question
yeah, sure.
for you. Because
yeah.
you were about to say, any thoughts on that? Was that what you were about to ask?
Say
me?
That again.
Were yeah. you about to say, are, I do thought you have any thoughts did. On that? Yeah, well. So let me ask you this. Again, my mind's just running yeah. through this. So we yeah. see this, the washing with water.
Yeah.
Is this the first time we see this really starting to come, like this washing with water, the kind of the ritual cleansing before they come? Is this
I don't
the
know.
First?
That's a good question. My impression would be no.
Because it seems like it's just said. Yeah.
Right. I think that it's possible. Let me do some research on that, and we'll think about that the next time. But certainly the water is a cleansing, right? It's a, mm-hmm. it's a, again, a setting apart. I do know that there were other kinds of setting apart that was done in this way. The first one that comes to mind is obviously the Exodus, covenant ceremony in, I think it's Exodus 18, but their blood, right? It's not water. It's blood is sprinkled on the people. Mm-hmm. And basically God says that you are now receiving the covenant. You're being my set apart covenant people. And so that was the first thing that came to mind, but I can't think of another water thing other than okay. the Red just, Sea,
just, yeah.
which,
you which know, is referenced in what? Second Peter,
Second Corinthians,
It's in a Peter. It's in a Peter somewhere. There's two.
What are you talking about? The Red Sea?
No, not the Red Sea. Sorry, I'm a liar.
Oh, the covenant ceremony.
I was thinking about Moses cutting through the Red Sea.
Yeah, I don't know what you're talking about there, but the
Noah in the flood. It was Noah in the flood. I'm an idiot.
Yeah,
just
it's
go
Noah.
On.
Noah.
And I'm just. That's okay. If you are listening right now. I apologize.
But it is mentioned in I said 2 Corinthians, but it's actually, I believe, 1 Corinthians chapter 10. You've got the, that basically he says that all of them were baptized. The whole nation of Israel was baptized in the Red Sea. Do you remember that passage?
Mm-hmm. Yes, that I do remember.
Yeah, and so that's what I thought you were referring to. That's the first thing that came to my mind is 1 Corinthians chapter 10. What was I going to say? So did you have another question? Was there anything? Oh, the washing with water. But it's not only that. We're going to see also that the sacrifices are going to be offered, and we'll mm-hmm. see that in just a minute. Go ahead and read then verses 11 through 13 then, if you will. 10 through 13.
10 through 13. Then Moses took the anointing oil and anointed the tabernacle and everything in it, and so consecrated them. He sprinkled some of the oil on the altar 7 times, anointing the altar and all its utensils and the basin with its stand to consecrate them. He poured some of the anointing oil on Aaron's head and anointed him to consecrate him. Then he brought Aaron's sons forward, put tunics on them, tied sashes around them, and fastened caps on them, as the Lord commanded Moses.
So you see what I'm talking about, this idea of consecrated is repeated. Repeatedly, but the anointed, it's interesting, the tabernacle's anointed, the altar's anointed, and then Aaron is anointed, right? So like I'm saying, it's almost like he's a part of the furniture, he's a part of the complex. And I would say it's true when they're in that role, when they're in that role of high priest, they're serving as kind of the active part of the tabernacle, if you will, the kind of the action part of the tabernacle. Mm-hmm. And they're the ones who are supposed to do things the right way. They're the ones who are supposed to know the law and these kind of things. And then we're going to see that there are burnt offerings made. And we're not going to look at all these passages because we talked a lot about offerings before. Mm-hmm. But here's, I think this is, it was actually this passage that sparked my mind that said, oh, this is kind of starting the whole thing up. Because if you don't have priests, right, who's going to offer sacrifice?
Right.
And so in this case, Moses acts as God's prophet, right? He acts on his behalf in offering the sacrifice on behalf of Aaron and his sons. That has to happen before they can then in turn offer sacrifice, if you see what I'm saying.
Yeah.
So Moses is the one who served in this role of priest, if you will, in this very first instance as they're getting this set up. Now, if you look down the very last part of Leviticus chapter 8, we see that it's a special ceremony, and it's called ordination. We could call this a very special ceremony in which they're set apart to this particular role. And so that's down in verses 30 through 36 or so.
Okay.
We see that. Do you want to read that for us?
Yeah. So this is chapter 8, verse 30. Then Moses took some of the anointing oil and some of the blood from the altar and sprinkled them on Aaron and his garments and on his sons and their garments. So he consecrated Aaron and his garments and his son and their garments. Moses then said to Aaron and his sons, cook the meat at the entrance to the tent of meeting and eat it there with the bread from the basket of ordination offerings, as I was commanded. Aaron and his sons are to eat it. Then burn up the rest of the meat and the bread. Do not leave the entrance to the tent of meeting for 7 days until the days of your ordination are completed, for your ordination will last 7 days. You want me to keep going here?
Yeah, go ahead.
Okay. What has been done today was commanded by the Lord to make atonement for you. You must stay at the entrance to the tent of meeting meeting day and night for 7 days and do what the Lord requires, so you will not die. For that is what I have been commanded. So Aaron and his sons did everything the Lord commanded through Moses.
So, yeah, interesting things here. So what I was starting to say earlier, how do you start this up? Well, you have to know what these sacrifices are first. That's why I think the first 7 chapters lay out these sacrifices. And now you see some of them in action, right? You see some of these sacrifices mm-hmm. that are offered. Moses is the one who does some of these burnt offerings. He takes some of the blood and as well as oil and sprinkles it on Aaron and on their garments and uses that to again, kind of make holy, if you will, or consecrate, set apart for this special service is maybe a way we would talk about consecrating, setting it apart for a special service, a special thing that they need to do. And so here's you know, Moses acting in that way for on behalf of Aaron
so,
and his
sons.
I
don't think we'd probably say this, but Moses is kind of acting like the high priest here.
He is.
First high priest or, you know?
No, he's not, but he's like, how do you become the first high priest?
High priest.
This is what I'm talking about.
Well, the Lord to make atonement for you. Well, that's what the sacrifice is for, but they're not prepared to make the sacrifice yet. And so
this is an interesting, you can actually look historically a couple times. And this is one of those weird questions that I had when I was a kid. It's similar to the day of Pentecost, right? If you need to be baptized to baptize somebody, then who's the first person that gets baptized, right? To like, you know,
right,
you see
yeah.
what I'm saying? Like,
there's got to be an action. There's got to be some intervention in the moment
to begin it, right? And that's the role I think Moses is playing here. So it's really, I said prophet, but he's kind of an intermediary between God and even the priesthood here in this case. He's the one who's received the commands. He's the lawgiver, right? He's the one that God has used in that way. And that's why I think in a special way, Jesus then becomes kind of, you know, in the New Testament, where you see he's even greater than Moses, right? But there's a similarity here. In Deuteronomy 18, is that where it is? Moses, is it Deuteronomy 18? There's a passage.
as it is said
somewhere in the law, there's another prophet who's going to rise from among you who's like me. You are to listen to him, right? Moses is pointing already toward this other new lawgiver that's going to come and, you know, make things different again. Mm-hmm. And so I think that's, you know, that's the equivalent of what we see here. He is kind of the initiator. He is the initiator of this sacrificial system. But no, he doesn't really serve in the role of high priest. It's really kind of the installer of the high priest, if you will.
Gotcha.
In the same way that God gave him the commandments for the tabernacle, as an example. But then it's these, Oholiab and the other dude are the ones who built the tabernacle, right? God equipped them. He specially sent the Holy Spirit to empower them in order to build the tabernacle. So it's a similar kind of way, I think. God has given the commands to Moses about how this is to be done. He reveals those things to Aaron, and then we have them filling that role.
Okay.
Does that make sense?
Yeah, that makes sense. No, but okay. I think that's a good thing for us to think about is like, how do you get this started? Because you got to have the high priest, or right. You got to have the priest that have something about them that's different than just a regular person.
What would you say so far? What we've read so far, what would you say what we're looking for in Leviticus is what this teaches us about God. But what would you say specifically it says about the leaders that God has set aside for his people, would you say? What we've seen so far.
That they need the same thing that the rest of us do.
Okay, it's interesting because not only, I think that's an important point, and we'll get to that maybe
They're not special, but they need to sacrifice for themselves
so they're in need of redemption. Forgiveness of sins just like the rest of us, right? But they do have a role that's going to have a very important place within this, and therefore there are some requirements that are placed upon them. There are some special in certain matters, and we're going to see this through the rest of the law. Through the rest of the book of Leviticus, there are some things that other people would be allowed to do that priests are not allowed to do, just because they have this role. And we'll see more about this, I think, in just a little bit. Look at Leviticus chapter 9, verses 1 through 4. So here's the beginning then, after they have been consecrated, after they've been set apart. So they've had, by the way, the 7 days, I didn't mention this. What we think, it doesn't explicitly say this, but it says you're going to do this for 7 days. The thought is that these sacrifices were repeated for 7 days, that basically God was commanding them that this was going to be a week-long kind of consecration. So it draws attention to what a crucial role they were going to play within the community, I think is kind of what we see here.
Would that 7 days, because I don't know the history of this, does that correspond with like Hanukkah when Judas Maccabeus and like the repurification of the temple? I mean, I know that's 8 days, but like, was there some kind of...
It's a week, but I don't think there's any specific, as far as I know, there's no specific...
I just didn't know because they had that amount of time for consecrating, like if this was a similar thing.
I don't know if we know the date of this or not. I'll have to look at that,
too. I'm just drawing random connections here with the Bible, everyone. So I'm just asking questions. Well,
in chapter 9, verse 1, it does say on the 8th day, right? So after these 7 days. And so we do have, it's not only, we have an 8th day. Let me draw the connection between the Gospel of John. There's no surprise there. But on the there are 8 days of the Feast of Tabernacles as well, and the last and greatest day of the feast is the one in which Jesus says, basically, anyone who's thirsty, let him come to me and drink, the one believing me, right? Mm-hmm. So, anyway.
Okay.
Chapter 9, verse 1. On the 8th day, Moses summoned Aaron and his sons and the elders of Israel. He said to Aaron, take a bull calf for your sin offering and a ram for your burnt offering. Again, think about this. Both of those we learned about in the last seven chapters of this book, right? Or, you know, the first seven chapters of this book before we get to chapters 8 and 9. So take a bull calf for your sin offering, a ram for your burnt offering, both without defect, present them before the Lord. Then say to the Israelites, take a male goat for a sin offering, a calf and a lamb, both a year old and without defect for a burnt offering, and an ox and a ram for a fellowship offering. Remember that fellowship offering?
They're going to have a party together.
Here. Well, and it's to be offered on behalf of the priest, right? The priests are going to, this is kind of they're part of what they're going to eat. To sacrifice before the Lord, together with a grain offering, mixed with olive oil, for today the Lord will appear to you. So, you know, here's the beginning of this sacrifice. So they talked about it in chapter 7. They've consecrated the people who are going to be the leaders of this sacrificial system. And now we find the beginning of it in chapter 9. Down in verses 12, go ahead and read 12 through 15.
Yeah.
I want you to notice there it says specifically that what we were just talking about. Go ahead and read that for us.
Then he slaughtered the burnt offering. His sons handed him the blood, and he splashed it against the sides of the altar.
He, by the way, is Aaron here, I should say. Yeah.
They handed him the burnt offering piece by piece, including the head, and he burned them on the altar. He washed the internal organs and the legs and burned them on top of the burnt offering on the altar.
Just like it said in the, you might remember, it said that that's the way it was to be done, right?
Yeah. Keep going here.
Yeah.
Aaron then brought the offering that was for the people. He took the goat for the people's sin offering and slaughtered it and offered it for a sin offering as he did with the first one.
And remember what we talked about, the sin offering was to make atonement. Mm-hmm. So here, and this is what we were just talking about, the priest had to offer sacrifices for themselves first for their sins in order to be in a position to offer sacrifices on behalf of the sins of the people. Mm-hmm. And again, it's a reminder that they are, even though they're very important and even though they are representing an important role that later we're going to find being filled in a fuller way, they are not ultimately going to be able to deal with sin, right? They have to deal with their own sins first before they can do what's necessary in order to make atonement for the people. So there's a passage in Hebrews, a couple of maybe. Go look at Hebrews chapter 7, 26 for me, 26 through 28. And it refers, I have to say, throughout this entire series so far, I always want to bring up the book of Hebrews, but I've been trying to avoid doing it every step of the way. But I thought this was interesting. What the Hebrew writer says here.
Here we go, 26 through 28, Hebrews 7.
Yeah,
such a high priest truly meets our need. One who is holy, blameless, pure, set apart from sinners, exalted above the heavens. Unlike the other high priests, he does not need to offer sacrifices day after day, first for his own sins and then for the sins of the people. He sacrificed for their sins once for all, and for all when he offered himself. For the law appoints as high priests men in all their weakness, but the oath, which came after the law, appointed the Son, who has been made perfect forever.
So what do you think of that? What does that bring to your mind?
I don't know what you're asking, Jesus. we don't need a high priest anymore.
It is Jesus. Well, but the contrast here, that idea, and you see it. This is what's cool about Leviticus here, I think, is you see this. They have to offer sacrifice for their own sins first, and this is why I think the Hebrew writer is the one that perhaps more than any other continually refers to the sinlessness of Jesus. You know, all the way back, you know, he's tempted in every way as we are, yet without sin. All the way to the very beginning of the book of Hebrews, you get this. You get, you know, repeatedly this idea that he's been made perfect, like you see here in this. So Jesus doesn't have to offer sacrifice for his own sins, and therefore his sacrifice is of a different character. It follows this model. Right, we understand what it is because of the sacrificial system, but he steps into this role of high priest in a different way than any of the high priests who'd come before. And he is able to offer a sacrifice that is effective, not needing to be repeated day after day, but is effective once for all. And so again, I think there's a good connection that, you know, with this, that helps us understand the significance of it. I'll just quickly read this. This is verses 11 through 14 too. It's a similar kind of thing. Here's the picture, though. The Hebrew writer says, day after day, every priest stands and performs his religious duties. Again and again, he offers the same sacrifices, which can never take away sins. Isn't that an interesting image? That here they've been doing it all this time. So you might ask the question, well, what is it all for? But when this priest had offered for all time one sacrifice for sins, he sat down at the right hand of God. And since that time, he waits for his enemies to be made his footstool. For by one sacrifice, he has made perfect forever those who are being made holy. I love that because it kind of gives you that image that he is, you know, the priesthood. It would have been an onerous task, right? Mm-hmm. Every day you're going and you're offering sins on behalf of yourself, and then sacrifice for sins on behalf of the people. So every day you offer sacrifice for your own sins, then you offer sacrifices on behalf of the people. And Jesus, though, on the other hand, because he is holy and blameless and without sin, is able to stand and offer that sacrifice once for all. It's, I think, the emphasis the Hebrew writer's making. Mm-hmm. And then he sits down, right?
It's done.
John, it is finished. It is completed, right? And so there's the helping us understand, you know, I think thinking about that system helps us to understand what an incredible act it was that Christ gave himself on behalf of us all. And so that's the thing I would like you
to
see.
Let me ask about this, and we kind of bring this up. You know, Hebrews talks about, like, the blood of bull and goats can never take away sin.
Sure.
So in that context, as we're thinking about this, is it more like can't permanently take away sin, or like how should we think about that? Since we've been referring to Hebrews here, like how should we think about that?
That's a pretty deep theological question.
Okay.
And I'll say, I don't think it kind of takes care of sin until the next time. I don't think it effectively deals with sin, and it is because the life that I deserved to have to give, right? The life that I have forfeited because of my sin is not equivalent to the animal that is asked to take my place. So I don't think it effectively dealt with sin, but it was God's way, I would say, of saying, I'm going to offer you this way that if you participate in it, will show that you are waiting for what I'm ultimately going to accomplish.
So it's kind of a merciful way for them.
I think so. Like I said, I think it's grace. I think there's a grace to it, or mercy may be a better word. You know, that God is saying, here's something you can do. But it's also, you know, Paul calls it a teacher. It's leading us toward this understanding what this sacrifice. So I think it's a necessary, this sacrificial system is a necessary part of the plan of redemption.
It's a preparer of a people.
I think so. I think it prepares. Yeah. And it's a consecrator. The other thing we haven't talked about too much, I mentioned it, and we'll see a little bit more of this even next week, because we're going to talk about some of the things that make you clean and unclean. But you know, consecrating, I talked about separating from sin as well. And you said preparing the people, they're being set apart from the cultures, both the one they came from and the one they're going into. Mm-hmm. And again, this was one of God's, it's always hard when you talk about emotional words when it comes to God, but his concerns, you know, I think God's sitting there going,
what are they going to do?
but I think God's, you know, as God looked at his people as they entered into the promised land, he was very clear, you need to do away with his people, because if you don't, you will serve their gods. It's going to become a temptation for you. And in fact, God ends up knowing what he's talking about because they don't do what he tells them to do and they end up suffering for it. Speaking of which, we're going to get to this in just a minute with this particular story of the priesthood. So disobedient, you know, God, maybe here's one of the lessons I think we can take from this. When we see God repeatedly saying, this is what needs to happen because if you don't, you won't, it is our obedience doesn't always have to be based upon our ability to understand the reasons for the consequences, right? Mm-hmm. Because God has said it, we can trust that there is good reason for it. Mm-hmm. And that he knows what he's talking about, so to speak, when this happens. So,
okay.
So there's an interesting case that takes place here. Let me read. This is the background for it first that I'm going to talk about. And maybe here, and here's the other thing I want us to think about and talk about a little bit today. And actually, it relates to what we've talked about some with Charles Taylor's book, Secular Age, because he makes a big distinction about this in the Reformation when the line between the set apart agents of God, the priest, right? Mm-hmm. That line between them and the average person was erased in the Reformation, which he sees as part of the move toward the secular age, that erasing this holy, you know, this holy space, mm-hmm. these holy set apart people, you know, erasing those distinctions. So any place becomes holy. Any person becomes a priest, right? Mm-hmm. Priesthood of all believers, which we believe is scriptural, you know, right? And as mm-hmm. Protestants, as you know, products at least of the Reformation, we understand that to be a biblical, you know, the truth. But he would say that erasing that has had negative consequences as well. And so what I guess here's where I'm going with this is, part of what I see in this whole part of the book of Leviticus is God trying to help Aaron and the priest understand why this role is such an important thing, and the people too, that this is a unique role, that this is a role that, you know, the high priesthood has literally a unique role. This is an important role, and what does it reflect? So anyway, as we look at this, kind of think about that as well. I know I didn't make that very clear, but here's the background for what I'm getting ready to talk about. It says, then Aaron lifted his hands toward the people and blessed them. So the sacrifices have all been done. They're all laid out. God, remember, God said, you're going to see me today if you do these things, right? Then Aaron lifted his hands toward the people, blessed them, and having sacrificed the sin offering, the burnt offering, the fellowship offering, he stepped down. Moses and Aaron then went into the tent of meeting. When they came out, they blessed the people, and the glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. So God's glory appeared. Mm-hmm. Yeah. I don't know what that looks like, but we usually imagine a great light. Mm-hmm. It's what we usually think of. The glory of the Lord appeared to all the people. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord. So the idea is that the presence of the Lord is in the Holy of Holies. Mm-hmm. It's where the Ark of the Covenant was. Fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed the burnt offering and the fat portions on the altar. And when all the people saw it, they shouted for joy and fell face down. Mm-hmm. Okay, so kind of awestruck, right? There, mm-hmm. The joy of here is our God. Here he is showing himself, right? We see his glory and we see his action in consuming this sacrifice that we have placed before him, our priest have placed before him, and then falling face down, I think is in the true sense of the word awe, right? They are truly in awe of God and can't stand in his presence, mm-hmm. and therefore they fall to the ground. We see other examples of this in scripture, obviously, face down, right? So they're not looking at God. That's the background of what we have here. Fire comes out from the presence of God, consumes the sacrifice. Questions or comments on that?
Anything? Yeah, so is this, so we would say this is when God's presence began to reside on the mercy seat?
Well, yeah, I mean, maybe. We already see it, though, right? Mm-hmm. The tabernacle's already been built.
Right.
We have, you know, God leading his people by a pillar of fire at night, mm-hmm. a pillar of smoke by day. But yeah, there's something that begins here, I think.
So is this when we think of when God has tabernacle? I mean, I know the tabernacle is built. When we say this is when God has establishing his presence,
I think so.
At this time. I mean, he's led them.
In a different way. Yeah, in a different way. Yeah, I think so. I think this is my mandated, this is going to be my, again, I always struggle with words because, you think about the nuances of it, but, people understood that God's presence wasn't limited to the tabernacle. I don't think the Jewish people understood that he was limited to the tabernacle, like other gods. In fact, they make mm-hmm. a big deal about that. Mm-hmm. It's not a box that he's kept in, right? But his presence is seen in a specific way mm-hmm. in this place. And so, this is probably the beginning of that.
The reason I ask that is, N.T. Wright talks about his whole thing is the main thrust point of all of this story is God residing with his people. Yeah. Coming, that was the whole point of the garden. God right. with his, walking with him in the cool of the day. Yeah. And we're finally to a place now where the sacrifices have been made. We have the priests in place. We've established this in such a way. There's a consecration that's happened with these offerings that it is now time where not just God can reveal himself, but that he is dwelling with his people then at this point inside.
Yeah.
In the Holy of Holies.
You mean in a way that he hadn't since the garden?
Yeah.
Maybe. How's that for a definitive answer?
Hey, everybody. Come into the Bible Bistro.
I think it's, I get what you're saying, and I absolutely agree with that idea. And not only, Greg Beale's, I can't remember the name of the book, but his book about worship is a good, mm-hmm. is really what I think explicates that well. So it's interesting to me that the tabernacle, let me say it the opposite way. When John looks into heaven, and is the door to heaven is opened up to John in the book of Revelation, mm-hmm. and he sees heaven. It's the shape of the temple. It's the shape of the tabernacle. And I think it's the other way around, actually, that the tabernacle is made in the shape of this realm of God. Mm-hmm. So what people are invited to do, this may be a good way to say this, what people are invited to do at the altar is to come into the presence of God. And in order for that to happen, they have to be cleansed, right? Mm-hmm. And they have to offer sacrifice on behalf of their sin. Because to come into the presence of a holy God is a awesome thing, literally an awesome thing. And we've seen people's reaction when they recognize the presence of God. So God in a different way, I would say, is now dwelling with his people. But God had met his people at various times along the path.
Yeah.
Right.
Yeah. Yeah. So I'm not saying, I guess my thing is yes, God has revealed himself in different times through the Exodus journey and so forth.
But tabernacle is a special way, especially
with this installment of them and the sacrifices happening now with the starting up, is there a change of relationship now that this has begun, that these that these sacrifices have been offered and so forth, and that's what we're seeing here with God manifesting his presence in this way and consuming the offering?
I hadn't preached for very long when I preached the sermon that I called the four temples, right, or the four mm-hmm. tabernacles. And you see the tabernacle here, mm-hmm. you see the temple at a later period of time, then you see Paul saying to the church, you are the temple of the Holy Spirit, right? And God's Spirit, God by his Spirit, lives in your midst among all y'all. And
gotta throw it in there.
It's plural.
Yeah, I know. I got you.
And then we have the where the whole world becomes the temple, right? In the book of Revelation, the presence of God there. Now there, mm-hmm. I will be their people, right? And I will be with them. And I will make my dwelling with them. That's the consummation of this, I would say. Mm-hmm. So we're not yet to where, I guess that's my only hesitation. We're not yet, he's not dwelling with them in a way that he's going to.
Oh, yeah. Right. But I'm just saying, yeah. Like at this point, like, is there a change of relationship here? And yes. If we can't say it, we can't say it.
No,
but
I think that's true.
This seems to me like as this is kind of this narrative is building, like, yeah. Hey, here's how to do this. And then, like, we are inaugurating something here. Yes. A change has come. We see these sacrifices finally getting ramped up. You know, Moses is doing this. Aaron is the high priest. The sons are priests after this. And we see, you know, there's offerings for the people and there's the fellowship. Yeah. It's like we're bringing them together and now God's showing himself. Now there's something different here.
And then the big deal then is when we see, because of Christ's sacrifice, the indwelling of the Holy Spirit in a, mm-hmm. that's a change in relationship as well. Mm-hmm. But again, even that's pointing, right?
It's a
deposit guaranteeing. Would
it be a seal, like a little mark?
According to Ephesians.
Yeah.
But you see what I'm saying is it's moving in that direction. Yeah. This is another step in the progress of redemption, I would say. Yeah.
Okay.
It's good.
All right.
So now let's talk about the negative stuff. So look at what happens. I'll let you read this. Nadab and Abihu are the names here. I'm sure you know that. Yeah. Chapter 10, verses 1 through 4.
Yeah. Aaron's son Nadab and Abihu took their censers, put fire in them, and added incense, and they offered unauthorized fire before the Lord, contrary to his command. So fire came out from the presence of the Lord and consumed them, and they died before the Lord. Moses then said to Aaron, "This is what the Lord spoke of when he said, 'Among those who approach me, I will be proved holy. In the sight of all the people, I will be honored.'" Aaron remained silent. Okay. You want to keep going here?
No, that's the farce I want to go. So right now, two sons of Aaron, Nadab and Abihu, offer the older translation. Yours said unauthorized. The NIV says unauthorized fire. The old version says strange fire, you know, and foreign, you know, is the word here, strange, mm-hmm. Outlandish, I suppose, unauthorized, right? Different words have been used to explain this. And do you notice, what is it that kills them?
Fire.
Fire that comes out from the presence of the Lord in the same way, right, that fire had done previously. Mm-hmm. So we find the fire that comes out. So what is it? So why? Wow.
I feel like I can see Moses's body language doing this. Like, right. This is what I told you would happen. Like, almost a hand.
Well,
and stanza.
And this gets tough here in a minute. I mean, this is hard to deal with. Think about Aaron. This is his sons, right? Mm-hmm. They just got burned to death. So go back a little bit then, and you know, why is this so severe? Why is this penalty so severe? And Moses, what does he say? It's not just I told you so, but this is what God meant, right? This is what God said. Mm-hmm. And basically, so here it's not, here's what I think we need to understand. And this is, you know, we always ask the question, what do we understand about God in relationship to this? I don't think it's about the priest, right? It's about the holiness of God. And that is not something to take lightly. Mm-hmm. And they, for whatever reason, we're going to talk about this. I'll talk about the different ways that this is sometimes understood. But for whatever reason, they did, specifically it says, what God had not commanded. That was the important part of this. Unauthorized fire, strange fire that God had not commanded. So they took it upon themselves to do this. And Moses' response is, God is going to be glorified by the priesthood. He's going to be seen holy before the people because of what they do. And their actions are not going to, you know, take away from that, essentially.
I'm just conjecture here. Sure. You know, I wonder if this is like calling back to what they came out of in Exodus. Like, it's just like, you know, I was reading a book. It was just like, you know, the one thing that kind of set Yahweh about was, is he's giving you his commands and he's outlining how you are to worship him.
Yeah.
And in these other syncretic, polytheistic things, it was kind of like, I'm kind of figuring it out as I go.
Right.
You know, are these guys just like, oh, it's another fire. It must be a sense of worship to him. And this is...
It could be. Are they, do they have, what are their intents? I mean, it's
total conjecture. Yeah. Like, what are their intents? It's just kind of like, oh, this is the God. And we just worship him in any way. Like, it's a carryover from what they've come from.
So there are a few different ideas about what's going on. So the two passages we probably need to look at, I'll look at Exodus 30 verse 9. You look ahead in Leviticus 16 verses 1 and 2.
Okay.
And these are two passages that possibly give us a little bit of a hint into what's going on here. Chapter 30 verse 9 says, "Do not offer on this altar any other incense or any burnt offering or grain offering, and do not pour a drink on it." So some people think it has to do with what incense that they are offering. They're offering something different than that which God had commanded. That's one possibility. Read Leviticus 16 verses 1 and 2.
"The Lord spoke to Moses after the death of the two sons of Aaron, who died when they approached the Lord. The Lord said to Moses, 'Tell your brother Aaron that he is not to come whenever he chooses into the most holy place behind the curtain in front of the atonement cover on the ark, or else he will die, for I will appear in the cloud over the atonement cover.'"
So, you know, it's interesting. This is the only other time we find this mentioned. And it's like, it says, okay, he says this to Aaron, whose two sons had died. And so another possibility is that, because what he's saying there is, don't do this at any time you want. You mm-hmm. only do this in the prescribed times. And so some people think that the strange incense here is that they are stepping outside of the prescribed times of burning the incense. And in that sense, that would be probably closest to what you said. There are some people who see this almost like, let me put it this way, God, you know, God doesn't answer to the priests, right? The priest answered God. Mm-hmm. And so they are not the ones. It's like, oh, look at this cool fire that, you know, came out of, well, I mean, I should mm-hmm. belittle. You get what I'm saying?
Gotcha.
We just saw that. We saw similar to
like
what
this is almost like a pagan conjuring.
Like the Egyptian, the Egyptian magicians is what I think. Not, you know, that you're not trying to, yeah, manipulate. I would say the difference between Christianity or worship of the true God and religion is an attempt to manipulate the deity into doing what we want him to do.
Which is what all the Egyptians were, you know, that was the Egyptian, the polytheistics typically are. It's like, I'm trying to appease them so they bless me. So
that
like,
is the basis. That is the basis of any religion, even bad Christianity, is me trying to twist God's arm to get him to do what I want him to do, right? Rather than conforming myself to his will.
That'll preach, won't it?
And so I've preached it once or twice. I think.
What are we talking about, deconstruction? Anyway, okay.
Anyway,
moving on.
So that's another possibility. Look at what's immediately following this. What does verse 5 say? And here's an interesting little tidbit that you notice when you study the whole book of Leviticus. This is the only time that God speaks directly to Aaron. But notice what the next regulations that he talks about here are. Let me see. And let me get back there because he basically tells the people who are supposed to take their bodies outside the camp, they're supposed to be taken outside mm-hmm. and left there. But then it says, verse 8, he says, "Then the Lord said to Aaron, 'You and your sons are not to drink wine or any other fermented drink.'" And some people think that maybe this indicates that Nadab and Abihu were drunk when they offered this strange fire. In other words, they were not. And the idea is you're not going to do things in the way you're supposed to, or you're mm-hmm. you know, going to be impaired in doing this.
They could all be true, couldn't they? In some way,
well, like, it could be. But yeah, I'm just offering.
Like, he could be drunk and offering at the wrong time, and like it's a combination right. of thing. That's how I got
right. It could be. But then Aaron, you get what Aaron's saying here, or God is saying to Aaron again. The only time he ever speaks to him is why would this specific regulation occur mm-hmm. right
or
here?
Or you will die.
Or you will die. And again, remember Moses had already said that you're to do these things in this particular way or you will die. So this is the reason this story is here is obviously this is an illustration of how serious and significant this role is. The last possible point here I was going to make, now I've forgotten what it was. Let me see. So we talked about the possibility that they're drunk, possibly they're offering the wrong incense at the wrong time. Oh, so the reason I gave you the background there, if we didn't have that chapter break between 9 and 10, then what we have is this fire comes from God and everybody else is awestruck face down. So it could be kind of a playing, you know, not seeing the seriousness of the awe, you know, not being in awe of God in the way that all the other people are, which is an interesting, you know, again, when you read it without the chapter break, you see what I'm saying?
Yeah, you might see that this is all one flowing story here where the presence of God has shown up, consumed, everybody's falling face down, and then here comes Aaron's son.
They're going to do this. And again, I think that now, if there's anything that goes together, I think it's them kind of saying, okay, well, let's see if we can conjure the same
Yeah, like thing. Dad just did it. Right. You know, Dad and Moses just did it. Let me see if we can fire it up.
Oh, that's interesting. I never thought about the fact it was two, like Moses and Aaron.
They did that. So let's see what we can do.
That's an interesting parallel. So, all right. Any other questions or comments on that?
I don't know. I love it.
Yeah, so let me finish up here, verses 8 through 11 of the end of chapter, or down a little bit further in chapter 10. Then the Lord said to Aaron, you and your sons are not, this is what I just talked about. Mm-hmm. But basically, what it says is you won't be able to distinguish between the common and the holy, is what he says. Mm-hmm. So the final question I kind of had for you, and I don't know how we're doing on time. I feel like we've been talking about this forever. But
we've got a few minutes here.
How does this translate, do you think, into our context then? I mentioned a little bit of what I was thinking about in terms of Taylor, who is kind of seems to be an advocate for, or at least would say that there have been unintended consequences when there's been an erasure between those who are consecrated people who are supposed to handle the holy things, right, and the common person. And basically, his, you know, to kind of flesh out the rest of that argument, he says the point is that then everybody kind of is given this is supposed to all the time, not just at special times, right? We're all supposed to be this kind of more is expected of us at this higher level. You know, that becomes the Puritan kind of Protestant work ethic and all those kind of things as well. And you know, he would say that the part of that has. You know, if everything is holy, then you know everything becomes common in a sense, in a manner. I didn't say that very well. He says it much better. But what do you think? How does this translate into our context? I guess
that's a great question. You know, I one of the things that's kind of popping in my mind is, especially as we just finished up this conversation, was thinking about. Eating and drinking judgment, you know, communion, right. Like as a priest, like there's something about how we come,
the manner in which we come,
the manner in which we come before, like how we come before, in 1 Corinthians, like everyone ought to examine themselves before they eat of the bread and drink from the cup. You know, there's this, how we come before God. And I mean, this is the importance of Christ on the cross, you know, like that he's, in some ways sanctifying us in that, but I think it's how, that there's a call on us as the priesthood of all believers, how we approach God and how we live. I don't know. I mean, what do you think about this?
I agree with that point that we sometimes can be a bit flippant when we come into the presence of God. And I think the story that we just finished with should teach us. No, it's even the Hebrew writer, you know, it's an awful thing to fall into the hands of the living God. We need to recognize we need to be awestruck in his presence, I think. The other point, though, I think leaders are held to a higher standard, and I think that's probably somewhat appropriate. Again, I'm not a believer in a strong distinction between quote unquote clergy and laity, even though right. you jokingly call me pastor. I call
you Pastor Brian, and you call me layman Ryan Sarver.
That's well, you ask for it. Yeah. But, you know, I do that in joking, but I do think that there's a higher standard called for leaders. And I suppose part of it is just, part of it is that when you see a leader who is caught in sin, there's usually wider repercussions within the community and this kind of thing. And it, we can think about very high profile examples of that, but also, smaller, more local profile, examples of that as well, that it has big implications. So I think for those of us who are in roles of leadership, we should think carefully about what important roles, act accordingly, I guess.
Well, and I think, yes, they held to a higher standard. And when they fall, at the same time, not be surprised. You know what I mean? Like, I think we're, at least for me, as I think, yeah. like, there's still, in Hebrews, we're talking about the high priests are, that they have a higher calling on them.
Yeah.
But they are still
human beings.
They're still human yeah. beings.
In need of forgiveness yeah. of sins.
And yeah. I think, as you see, Moses and Aaron don't make it to the promised land. Even they themselves, Moses sees it, Aaron dies beforehand, and then his sons, who are just been set apart, right. That have just been consecrated, fall down that rabbit hole. But I think it's that examination of ourselves and kind of going, yes, you are called to something higher, but also realizing that called to something higher, into a higher, doesn't also exclude you from the failings of humanity.
Humanity, and again, maybe makes us point again to the importance of the grace of God in Christ and His sacrifice, Him being whole, Him blameless, and the sacrifice mm-hmm. once for all. So, anyway, that's what I think this part of Leviticus kind of points us to, the leadership and the consecration of leadership, and mm-hmm. For God's people. But again, the reflection, this is where I was going with that. The importance isn't for the purpose of the priests themselves, but it's the way that they're reflecting God. You even see this in the kind of sacrifices that we saw in the last section that are required to be brought, but without defect, the best of your flocks and herds, that's what's supposed to be brought before the Lord. So it reflects upon His majesty, mm-hmm. His glory, is what we're looking toward, I think.
Yeah, that's great. Hey, you know what? I'm kind of liking this Leviticus.
Good.
I'm going to give it to you. I mean, it's good to reflect on some of these things, to think back about how did this all look out, and that it was why these things, just as we examine why did this happen, what are potential causes, but kind of going, when they fail to reflect something, that's when the judgment comes in. You know what I mean? Like, you have a call to reflect the holiness, the otherness of God in this way. So I think it's really good.
I hope you still enjoy it next week when we talk about why you can eat a cow and not a camel. So.
I've been to Egypt and I still haven't had camel, so I don't know. I'm sure I could have had it. But anyway, all right. Well, Brian, thanks so much.
Yeah,
excited to continue in this Leviticus series, and we'll chat with you next week.
All right. See you then.
See you. Bye-bye.